I had a bad dream once. Well, I had several in my lifetime, but only two or three that stand out in my mind that I could recall in accurate detail today. And this is a true story, I may add. At least the dream was true. I'm only too thankful that the story of the dream wasn't. But you'll see what I mean when I tell you. It happened many years ago, and I'd come back from somewhere, I think it was South Africa or New Zealand, where they often wear shorts as part of their daily attire. In fact, in the city of Durban, I don't know whether it's still true, shorts were formal dress. You could go to a solicitor's office, so long as you were wearing the proper safari suit and a pair of shorts. And many of the officials who get off the plane in New Zealand, the officials there, the customs officials, are dressed in shorts. And they have what they call walk socks, which is, you know, these long things that come up to the knee. Now, they're very comfortable, you know, you can walk around in them. And apart from the more formal occasions of the actual Bible school I was at, I spent most of my time in these things. Well, when I got home, you see, it was a bit irksome to put on the old longs again, and I thought I would at least have a pair of shorts for gardening. And since it's rather a waste to have a pair of shorts just for gardening, my wife, with brilliant sense of ingenuity, took an old pair of longs and chopped the bottom off. So I had an excellent pair of gardening shorts, and it was an excuse to sit out in the deck chair and watch the weeds grow and garden away. That was it, you see. That is true. Now, the dream, and the record of it is true, centers around, you know, those things where a lot of things go together, and when you're dreaming, it's sort of true but isn't. And while you're in a situation, it changes, and you've moved on to another, and it just doesn't quite fit when you try to tell it after, but it does at the time. And sometimes you can wake up in a cold sweat. Well, on this occasion, I had on my shorts. I'd also forgotten to shave. It wasn't a deliberate attempt to grow a beard, you know, that takes a long time. And even when you're doing that, you go through this period where it's a 5 o'clock shadow becomes 12 o'clock shadow, and in the end it just looks awful. Well, this is the night before, and it was in the afternoon. I mean, I'd been gardening after all. But I had to speak that evening at a youth campaign. Yes, an ecclesia had had the foresight, in my opinion, to hand over the preaching, the public preaching, the campaign, to its young people. They were all about those young people because they'd asked me to speak, you see, so it couldn't have been all bad, could it? So I thought. And the place where I was gardening was outside the hall, the town hall. And I was trimming the hedge, thoroughly enjoying my gardening shorts and the actual experience of gardening. And then suddenly, this was about 6 o'clock, and I was 20 miles from home. I looked at the notice board and it said lecture at 6:15. So I realized I was in trouble. Because there was I, with gardening shorts beginning to fray, you know, in the proper fashion around the bottom. And the beard was now 6 o'clock shadow. And people were starting to come. The organizers were there. All these bright young people. So I thought, well, the only thing I can do to hide my shame is hastily to go into the anteroom behind the stage and wait in the wings, as it were, not daring to show my face until I was summoned to the platform, when I would slip smartly and disguise everything except this. And I could always claim, if challenged, that it was on the way. It was doing quite nicely. Well, then suddenly my president appeared. He was a young man I knew well. Fortunately, he was no one I recognized in the sense that I could recall him now, because perhaps he wasn't a real person. He was a kind of composite person. Because he hadn't shaved either, not that day, or for many, many moons, and it was sort of... He had the very latest in presiding brothers wear, open neck badges stuck all over, even one there, which proclaimed some message or other. And I thought, well, I can't say much, can I, really, because perhaps I needn't step out quite so smartly after all. And the stewards were there, and they were all in costume. Not a single older brother or sister from the ecclesia. And I thought, well, now, you know, we're all in the same boat. What can I say? I'm completely unprepared. I mean, I've done a bit of gardening, but I hadn't bothered to check up. I hadn't bothered to prepare myself. I didn't even have my Bible. I had no notes. I would have to make it up as I went along. And this was a campaign for the preaching of the truth. And in preaching the truth, you are also projecting an image. It ought to be the image of Christ, but people do look, you know, and see who it is that spot this message. Sometimes they equate the message with the people. They shouldn't do, but they do. And you've got to face that fact. And to have a speaker in gardening shorts with a 6 and 15 shadow was, you know, and I could only... You will be glad to know that my attention was distracted completely from the organizers, because I thought, well, here we are in the same boat. This is what happens when we don't give a little bit of thought in advance to what we are doing, and when we don't really prepare ourselves. You know, we have the truth, we can do a campaign. You might even have been very diligent in giving out bills, but there is a style of approach which is appropriate on some occasions, and shorts and a beard for gardening are one thing, but to stand behind and proclaim the gospel of Christ, maybe, is entirely different. Well, just to round the story off, unless you think that this is a talk aimed at young people, and it is not, I assure you, aimed at. The older brothers and sisters were coming. Because up the stairs, not the side stairs I went up, but up the main door, there they were all coming. I could see the faces now, many of them I knew, and they were all in their suits. And I thought, well, it's wonderful after all. The ecclesia has cooperated. They're gone. The young people and the old people are all together. But they came up the stairs, they went left, and the lecture was there. Because they were going to see a film on Israel, I hasten to say. It was a good film, there's no reason why they shouldn't have seen it. But they were doing their thing, and they were doing theirs. And I was in the middle, and I certainly wasn't fit to go in that one. And I wasn't prepared to be in this one either, in the sense of ready for the job that I had to do. Now, in a sense, that's a little parable. That is true, that dream. And I awoke in a cold sweat, I assure you. Whenever you have a nightmare, my dear young people, be thankful when you wake up. And it isn't true, because none of that is true. But it could be, couldn't it? In a sense, if you start putting together all the little elements that there are, and supposing that picture ever did come true, that we were really polarizing in that direction, that we were really getting slap happy about our preparation to preach the word, that we were really sinking into the thing where when you say clothes don't make any difference and therefore you can't worship God any better in a best suit, which is absolutely true, we also say we have to give no thought whatsoever to what we offer to the Lord, whether it be ourselves or our presence or our message. And I think there's a great future in front of the Christadelphian community when we can now begin to pull together on the essentials and have that family spirit in which a gathering like this, which has brought together young people, is a feedback into the ecclesias. When you go back to ecclesias, small groups. Take them back your enthusiasm. Take them back a breath of Swanwick. Something that you've learned and discussed. They'd like to know what you thought about it. They will be surprised to find what you've remembered. It'll give them a new view on you and on Swanwick. It'll give them a new view on the letter to the Hebrews, perhaps. But try it. Because in that way, Swanwick fulfills, as it's fulfilled throughout its years, its proper purpose, and that is not to integrate people here, but to be a seabed for integration outside, where young people are fired with imagination and enthusiasm and go back and say, well, this is how it ought to be in our ecclesia. And whenever we say that, we mean this is how I ought to start being in my ecclesia. Not how they ought to start being for me, but how I ought to start being for them. So that was the message, and I've always been glad I have that dream. I don't tell it very often. But what's that got to do with my subject? Well, only that our subject has taught us to look for the better way all the time. To see the development. You need God's purpose develops. There are good things. There are better things. There are excellent things. And in spite of what the English teachers tell you, you can have more excellent things in God's book. Excellent meaning means the best there is. And how can there be any better than that? Well, in God's book there is, as we shall see. Hebrews chapter 8. Now, if you want to pull together the threads of what we've been talking about this weekend, chapter 8 is good. Because it says, now of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. Now, that doesn't mean the summary. You've got it all here summarized for you. It means the real point, the point at issue, the point around which we are revolving in our talk. And it is this. We have such an high priest, that's the one we've been considering, such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. And that means he's taken his seat there and his work is there and it's continuing. A minister of the true sanctuary, of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. That's a little allusion to when God brought Israel out of Egypt, actually, where they sang the great song of Moses and the Lamb, and the Lord had become their salvation. And at the end of that song of Moses, it says that they would come to the mountain and establish there the sanctuary which thine hands have made. So it was the Lord's sanctuary. You see, it wasn't the one that was made in the wilderness at all. That was good. In fact, it was excellent. But there's something better than that. And every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, whereof it is necessity that this man have somewhat to offer. Christ has to offer something. If he were on earth, he wouldn't be a priest. And we saw why that was true, because he wasn't a Levite even. And there are priests. There were priests doing that very thing, offering gifts according to the law. But that was only a shadow, verse 5, an example, a pattern, and a shadow of heavenly things. So what happened on earth in the history of Israel is now something which is in heaven. Now listen to this. But now he, that's Jesus, hath obtained a more excellent ministry. And the word ministry there means literally, the word literally means a folk work, something you do with, for, and with people. And the Lord works with people always. But it's a more excellent thing, more excellent. Much better than something that was extremely good. By how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant which was established upon better promises. So for us, even now in the 20th century, it's all better. And if we are partakers of it, we want it always to be always better. And how is it better? Well, let him tell us. If the first covenant had been faultless, there'd have been no place found for the second. And that means that there was nothing the matter with the covenant. There's a lot the matter with the people. It was the kind of covenant that you can't keep. So you had to keep on offering sacrifices and gifts and keep on and on and on. It never, said the apostle, made the comers thereunto perfect. But finding fault with them, he said, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, I will make a new covenant. Not according to the covenant I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not. It's a two-way process, that. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord, I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their heart. You know, this is why you don't harden your heart. Because if you do, nothing gets written on it. The apostle says to the Corinthians that the real law of God was not written on the tables of stone, but the fleshy tables of your heart. So if you're hardening your heart, and if you don't want to know, then nothing is going to get written there. Make no mistake. That's what he's saying. But let it be written there. And this is what happened. And what he writes is this. I will be to them a God. And they shall be to me a people. They shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord. For all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. Why? And this was the better thing. Better than the promises to Abraham, which have yet to be fulfilled in as far as Abraham is concerned, but when they are going to be fulfilled, they're going to be better than Abraham ever knew, because he was looking for a land which he will get, and a nation which belonged to him which he will have. Better than the covenant with David, which was his king shall sit upon the throne and he would see it. Because it's founded on the only thing that makes that possible for Abraham and David and you and me. Look at having an eternal kingdom if there aren't some eternal men, is it? And this is what God says. This is the better promise. Implied all the way through, right from the beginning, I will be merciful to their unrighteousnesses, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. Now, when we had that list of witnesses yesterday, all these people were looking forward to something which was greater even than they knew. They looked forward to its coming. Abraham rejoiced to see my day, said Jesus, and he saw it and was glad, and there was something to go with. When they get there, when they with us are made perfect, what is it? They died in faith, not having received the promises, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. And the letter to the... I jotted this down once some time ago. It's not my own, I got it out of a book, but it wasn't a bad book either, because it tells us. Gives you the sort of two parts of the letter to the Hebrews. They're not two separate parts, but they integrate with each other, and one is shows us clearly those excellent things which God did, and the more excellent things he's left for us. Just as the Apostle Paul says, the old covenant had no glory. Well, it did. It was made glorious, we're told. But he hasn't finished yet. It had no glory by reason of the glory that excelleth. So everything that was wonderful about the gold and the gems and the silver and the gold-plated mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant in all its beauty, and even the later temple, was nothing compared with the beauty of holiness here. Now you see, the original promises were based on the covenant to Abraham and the patriarchs, the inheritance of the land. And the law was a covenant of works. You had to do something all the time. And the letter brings out all the lessons of the Exodus and the giving of the law of the covenant, the conquest of the land, the setting of the tabernacle, the Day of Atonement, and all that it meant. And then it suddenly shows us that the thing that all this was the shadow of is what? Fellowship was the word. Partaking. That the Gentiles, that anybody who in faith, having it mixed with faith, says the apostle in the Hebrews, anybody for whom faith plays an important part in their understanding, they believe it as well as know it, for them it's the covenant of divine fellowship to be brought near to God, to draw near to him. And in drawing near to him, we have as our brother, not ashamed to call us brethren, the Lord Jesus Christ himself, the risen Lord. The very first thing he did, you know, was to go and send for his brethren. Have you ever thought about that? You know, he has a word with Mary and gives her that important message. He shows himself alive to her because, you see, the women are faithful like that. They were the last at the cross and the first at the tomb. You see, the disciples had gone off. And that's in their character as well as their spiritual development. You put the two together and you've got that beautiful thing that brings Mary there at early dawn and the Lord speaks to her. But the first message is, go and tell my brethren. Oh, and Peter. Yes, I know that he fell rather badly, but don't let him think he can't come. He's coming too. And they all came, brethren and sisters of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, this is the way I like to think of the better thing now that is revealed in the letter to the Hebrews. Some of you heard me say this before. I don't apologize, because for me it sums up the closeness of our relationship with God. How close it is. What it's based on. Why it is important that we should think carefully about what we are doing and how we come. And what is the power of prayer and what it really does for us. And it's really summed up, quite simply, in the insight that the letter to the Hebrews gives us into what the tabernacle in the wilderness was all about. And you'll remember that in chapter 9 it just says that through the tabernacle in the wilderness the Holy Spirit was signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest. Nobody could find the way. Even if they knew the way, they couldn't find it. They couldn't go there themselves, because unless you were a priest or a Levite, then you didn't come closer than the door of the court. If you were a Levite, you went inside the court. If you were a priest, you could go into the holiest place. But the sort of focal point where God dwelt and met with Israel was behind a curtain. Well, yeah, it was only a curtain. It wasn't a great wall. You could go. Somebody could go. In fact, the high priest used to go once a year. But he didn't go any old how. You see? It's very interesting that the law about the Day of the Atonement was spoken immediately after two priests had died, because they thought they could go anywhere. They were half drunk, apparently. So their mind wasn't on the job, was it? Because their mind wasn't on the job, they thought that fire was as good as that fire. And they offered that fire. And the fire came out and slew them. So speak unto the people and give Aaron the following instructions. Quite simple. There was the blood of the covenant, of course. Well, that makes sense, because that's how we come. By the blood of the everlasting covenant. Jesus was raised from the dead, we read. And that's important to us. And we come. Oh, the Lord Jesus Christ. Let's concentrate on him. first. With his own blood, as it were, his own life, his very self being offered, wasn't able to go through that veil into the presence of God. Not to do the high priest did come in and out, but to stay there, to sit there. That's where his work is. Then you see, the high priest had to take this cloud of incense. It was sweet, smelling incense. You couldn't use it for anything else. It had to be put together, the right ingredients, and tempered together, because it was designed so that when you burnt it in the morning, the perfume lasted till the evening, then you burnt some more again. And so that outer place was always filled with this kind of sacred presence now. But the high priest had to be covered in that. And if he said, well, I won't bother, and he did not put forth his hand and take the incense and put on the fire, then he died. Simple as that. But if he did, then it wasn't the high priest that went in, it was the high priest sanctified by this divine arrangement. He was now the representative, the type of Christ, wasn't he? And you know, you put two clouds together, and that's what they do. So when he went in within the veil, then the two clouds were one. That was fellowship, divine fellowship, partakers one with the other. That's where God was, that's where man was. And although the man couldn't see God, they were there together. So close as that, but only once a year. And only in symbol. And then they went out and blessed the people. Well, now you see, by our relationship with Christ, those who have been touched with the blood of the covenant, we are there. We are in that holy place. We offer our incense morning and evening, more often perhaps. But we don't offer it for ourselves. We offer it through Christ, and it's Christ's sweet savour that sanctifies it for us. And between us and the living God, there's just the veil. That's this stuff, the flesh it's called, through which the Lord passed. You see, he went through the veil at his death. In fact, the veil was rent in the temple just to show that that's where he was on his way, from top to bottom. So God must have done it, pulled it open like that to show that now, with the blood of Christ, the Lord was ready to enter in and sit right in there. But we can't do that. But you see, every time we offer our incense of prayer, in fact, the altar of incense, which really belonged in there, was put outside the veil. It's out there for daily use. The priest could use it. But a simple curtain, a loosely woven curtain, doesn't keep it out, you know. You still have the divine presence mingles with the presence of the man who uses the incense. And that's what prayer is like. It sort of goes into that which is within the veil. And although physically we are out here, we are part of that. Or as the letter to the Hebrews puts it, let us come boldly unto the throne of grace and find grace to help in time of need. Having therefore, brethren, boldness, that means the confidence to do it, not the recklessness to do it any way we think fit. The confidence to enter into the holiest by the blood of Christ, by a new and living way which he hath consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. And having an high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having, now look at this little inversion, this better thing, not having our bodies washed and our conscience still as it was before. That was the old way, an excellent way, because you could get close with your body washed, but now you have your heart sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Your baptism and your faith brings you that close. It's only this stuff between, and we'll get rid of this one day. And that's the better thing. It's that covenant of fellowship, which was implied in Abraham's covenant, because when God said, you will have a land, then Abraham believed God, and God counted it to him for righteousness. That's part of the covenant. That he would belong, he would be a partaker to. Well, there it is. That's what's set before us. The better way, the better thing, the thing that Abraham looked forward to, that he left everything for, that Moses gave up a career in Egypt for. And the thing which has been set before us, and we in a sense have lived to see, or at least lived to look back on, the accomplishment of it, and forward to the fulfillment of it. And the time will come when, just as the high priest used to emerge on the Day of Atonement and bless the people, so the Lord will come and say, "The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace."